My name is Josh Gunderson, and I work with Matt Hedman and Suzanne Staggs at Princeton on the PEAK experiment, and with Bruce Winstein, who's been visiting this last year from Chicago. And this is a follow-up talk to Matt's talk, and I'll be discussing the estimates of the polarization foregrounds near the NCP. And first I'll give an overview. Oh, by the way, this isn't a map that we made of the polarization. I'll give an overview and a motivation for this talk, and present some estimates of the brightness spectra, angular power spectra, maps, which are in quotations because they're not real templates. They're just scaled estimates of the polarization intensity near the NCP. And I'll talk a little more about atmosphere, although Matt pretty much covered it in his talk, and then I'll summarize. Just as an overview, there's been a lot of work on polarization foregrounds. This is by no means a complete list, but there was a workshop about a year or a year and a half ago at Princeton, which Angelica and Max wrote, edited, and there's a lot of good review papers in that for if you want to learn more about it. And there's been some more recent papers which I've drawn from for this talk. You might ask why we're interested in the region near the NCP. Adrian brought this up. It's not the greatest region of the sky, but it affords continuous observations. It's relatively low foregrounds. One nice thing is that the temperature maps already exist from Saskatoon, so we can, as soon as we make a polarization measurement, we can do the cross correlation. And several groups, including ourselves and maybe Compass, and I didn't know at the time when I was writing this whether Polatron was going to look there or not. I guess not. You haven't decided, okay. Well, so, but it's sort of a natural place to look if you want to do continuous observation. So, just as a review, these are current upper limits of the polarization. These are by no means robust. I've just sort of taken numbers out of literature and turned numbers into band powers. but as you can see, this dates all the way back to Penzias and Wilson up in the upper left-hand corner. And the best upper limits are actually at the smallest angular scales by recent results from the ATCA. Thanks. ATCA out here at 10 microkelvin, but we don't really expect much CMB anisotropy there. The most relevant one to us is actually upper limits from Saskatoon, which is about 25 microkelvin here at ELSA of about 100. So that's where we are, and we hope that this is going to change real rapidly and even maybe change this year. So that's the goal. And so here are current estimates of brightness temperature spectra of the polarization foregrounds. I've caveated it by saying that this is estimates near 0.2 to 0.5 degrees because we know that the angular power spectra of the foregrounds change. And I've also caveated it saying that's near the NCP. So this is by no means representative of the full sky. There might be better regions, et cetera. But OK, so on the vertical axis, we have polarization brightness temperature variations as a function of frequency. And let me just walk you through the various observations that constrain some of these foregrounds. Starting up here, the only maps that are fairly large-scale maps that have been done in polarization were by Brown's Blestra. And they made maps mostly of the, over large portions of the northern hemisphere and at a bunch of five frequencies here, low frequencies. And here are the RMSs that I calculated near the NCP of their data. Their data is very undersampled, so you can't use it for template spectra or anything. And there are a lot of other problems. For instance, you get large Faraday rotation, which can act to depolarize, et cetera. So what I've actually done is I've used their highest frequency band RMS here at 1.4 gigahertz. And I've scaled that using a beta of minus 2.9 to the higher frequencies. This guy was done the angular scale of this was at 0.6 degrees, so it is fairly close to our measurements. These guys were done at higher or larger beam sizes, and like I say, this is probably rolling over because of Faraday rotation effects. An interesting thing is if you scale this all the way back to Haslam, you get Haslam being more than 100% polarization. Obviously, that's not right. So what that's telling you is that there actually might be the synchrotron spectrum might actually be shallower at these lower frequencies than a 2.9 spectrum, and that's maybe one of the reasons. And there might be differences in the angular scales of the Haslam versus the Brown-Sylvester that might cause difference here. So anyways, but it's kind of interesting to note that the Brown-Sylvester data is about 10% of the Haslam here. So this is sort of the more correct number. Anyway, there have been other more recent measurements at 1.4 and at 2.4 gigahertz that they're not near the NCP, but they're far enough off the galactic plane that you can imagine that you're not being confused by local stuff in the galactic plane. What they're hopefully sampling is sort of the broad continuum emission caused by the synchrotron in the outside of the galactic plane. So these numbers are actually pretty consistent with the numbers from Brown-Sylvester. So I'm just trying to use consistency arguments that, you know, a few different experiments get roughly the same numbers up here. And then I scale this down to, and obviously this is a pretty large scaling here, a factor of 20 in frequency, down to the higher frequencies. And here all these triangles are not actually polarization measurements, they're total power measurements made by various groups. And of course these are at typically larger angular scales. And so you can't make direct comparisons, but you can sort of see that you're in the right ballpark here. So the most relevant one is the Wallach et al. Data, which is the Saskatoon data, and this is an upper limit. These triangles are sort of meant to show you that these are kind of upper limits to what you might think that the synchrotron is doing. And so however you draw this line, it has to kind of go underneath the Wallach et al. Number here. And this was also done at, you know, near the NCP, the Wallach et al. Measurement, and at the frequencies and angular scales that are of interest to us. So the other measurements that are done at larger angular scales, this is actually the estimate from the COBE measurement of the excess synchrotron emission. This is from the 19 gigahertz Bon et al. Data, and Angelica's figured out the correlation with the Haslam that would be representative of the synchrotron emission in the Bon et al. Data. So that's here. Then there's the Tenerife data, and this is the one that is sort of most, it's fairly puzzling to me. That was here, and then Angelica's talk the other day, it kind of bounced up by a factor of two here. Of course, on the log plot, it doesn't really help you that much. But so there's a discrepancy there, which I don't quite understand. But so I've tended to be on the conservative side, and so that this line in the synchrotron actually goes above that. So that's probably the most concern for the lower frequency measurements, you know, measurements below 40 or 50 gigahertz is the synchrotron. The other things, of course, that can hit you are thermal dust emission, spinning dust, and free-free, although I don't think anyone really believes that free-free is really that polarized. I've just put it up there for completeness here. The other plot, things that are on this plot are this is 2 microkelvin, it's roughly the RMS we expect from the E-mode polarization. And then if they're B-modes, I just divided that by 10. And so you can see that this is down here in the muck, down here. Anyway, the other things that can affect us are point sources. And you can't plot a single line here for point sources because they have a lot of different spectra. But what I've done is I've put up a 100 millijansky source as 10% polarized would give us a 2 microkelvin signal here, both at the W band and the Q band of the peak instrument. And they're the same there because we use the same collecting area for the two different instruments. So then there's thermal dust emission. So I'll go into a little more detail of how I actually normalized these other components that might be affecting us. But this is how I've done the synchrotron. It's been sort of normalized to the Brown's cluster data. So you can just look at what the Brown's cluster data looks like. You can tell all I've done, I mean, this is way undersampled. They're sampling, they sampled like every degree or a couple degrees. They just made a measurement and with a half degree, 0.6 degree beam. And so I've just really simply calculated the RMS in this region, and at 1.4 gigahertz you get something like 60 millikelvin. And then what I've done is I've just scaled it to 90 gigahertz using a spectral index of minus 2.9, and you come up with a temperature scale like this. So this is real rough. It's just sort of telling us that we're not going to get blown away by synchrotron, certainly not at 90 gigahertz, but at 40 gigahertz it might be a problem. And so these are the RMSs based on this scaling. So at 90 gigahertz, it's under a microkelvin. Well, at 40 gigahertz, it's comparable, or if not larger than the CMB expected CMB signal. So you could do the same thing with the Haslam. And here, in order to make this consistent with the Brown's cluster data, I basically had to assume 100% polarization. And so in order to make these RMSs come close, so you actually get smaller RMSs with the Haslam. So that's just a good rule of thumb. If you're using a beta of minus 2.9, you might want to just assume Haslam is 100% polarized in scaling if you want to make things consistent with Brown's cluster. So the other templates that I've used include the IRAS dust. So this is the IRAS dust near the NCP. And here, unlike the Brown's cluster, you have to actually throw in some arbitrary polarization assumption. And I've used 5% here, and then I've used this number of 5 microkelvin per megajansky per stradian to convert to what the expected signal is at 90 gigahertz. Then I've actually went around and did our scan strategy. I smoothed it to our beams at 40, 90 gigahertz. Went around and, you know, simulated our scan strategy and came up with RMSs. This is the RMS at 100 microns is about 2.1 megajansies per stradian. And when you scale that to 90 and 40 gigahertz, you get numbers that are under a microkelvin at 90 and way under a microkelvin at 40. This is just for standard dust emission. So dust is looking like not a problem, although, you know, this 5% number is kind of questionable. You mean this number, the 5 microkelvin per mega? Yeah, this is actually about the number that we got for max. So, oh, 80, yeah. Well, anyways, I think this is a decent number, right, Doug? And
so that's the number I would have given you, but remember we have some cold molecular clouds in this region, too.
Okay. Okay.
It
doesn't look like it's going to be a showstopper. So, and then this number of 1 microkelvin per megajansky per stradian is actually, that comes from, well, actually let me take a step back. A lot of people have thought about what percentage polarization that dust should be in. So this is just a plot by Prunay and Lazzari, and this is, I think, out of the proceedings from that Angelic and Max edited. But you can get pretty high percentage polarizations if you have pretty crazy models of the galactic magnetic fields. But more typical numbers are down here under 10%. And that's certainly more consistent with, I think, measurements at 100 microns in the galactic plane. They're kind of at the 5% level. And so that's what I've used. And you could just multiply my numbers by 2 or 3 if you think it's 10 or 15%. But still, we're probably in the clear there at 90 gigahertz. But then there's other concerns. This anomalous emission at low frequencies, if it's dust or spinning, or if it's spinning dust grains or free emission, that could also be polarized. And so I've come up with estimates of how much that could potentially contaminate us. And here I use this plot from COGIT to get the scaling from the IRAS numbers, the scaling in microkelvin per megajansky per steradian, to convert those numbers into estimated RMSs at 40 gigahertz. So there I use this 10 microkelvin per megajansky per steradian to figure out what free and spinning dust might contribute at 40 and 90. And there I get RMSs of, once again, close to a microkelvin. And yes, you have to also assume this 5% polarization, and you can scale this number if you think spinning dust is 10 or 15%. But it looks like the numbers are pretty low for both free and spinning dust here. So, and especially at 90 gigahertz. What's that?
How much further roughly had it further down?
For spinning dust? I think this is 0.01 or something. I mean, if you assume these models that Drain and Luzerne produce.
You can't really spin that fast.
Okay. So that's pretty wraps up the maps and the brightness spectra. A lot of people have thought about the angular power spectra, and these numbers I've actually I've taken numbers out of paper by Max to get the tilts of these angular power spectra, and then I've normalized them at L's of 100 and 200, where our Q and W band measurements are going to be. I've normalized the RMSs there. So this is the angular, what we would expect maybe for the angular power spectra if you normalized them to the numbers I just showed you. And here what we have is the CMB up here, of course. Then there's so this is the intensity. This is the polarization in light blue. This is the cross, the correlation. And here's the synchrotron. That's the only guy that stands substantially above the polarization signal. So that's the major worry at 40 gigahertz is this the polarization. But there's large uncertainty as to whether this thing is actually blue tilted as I've shown it here, or whether it's actually coming down at smaller angular scales. So, you know, if this thing were coming down, then we might be in the clear at the smaller angular scales. So I think there's a large amount of uncertainty here, and I've just tried to use my previous numbers to show what they might look like here. Max might have a better answer.
Angelica, for example, on Duncan map, has found that a blue spectrum like that, lower frequency. That's why he's kept that in sort of cross model. However, at the very least, the reason that Duncan map looks so choppy is that there's a parity location, so that it might be very choppy in E fields, on small scales. And at higher frequencies and parity location becomes relevant, all that small scale power might go away. I fully agree with Josh and that it could go anywhere.
And certainly, if you extrapolated that far enough, you have a situation with polarization and SSD is greater than the known temperature and SSD.
Well, but it's not. No, it's not going to be greater than the 3 Kelvin, though, right, for a while. And that's what you would be worried about.
But you're forgetting, Eric, that the intensity of the monopolar thing comes to you.
No, I'm not thinking about that.
Okay, no, obviously that can't have the radiation even more than 100% polar.
Right.
But
you know, it's not the monopolar.
I mean, this is just a single parameter fit over this, or a two parameter fit. So it's very nebulous at this point. So it's really. Actually, if someone is I think good improvements could be done on this using what Max is just saying, or that Angelica did, is there are existing maps now off the galactic plane at relevant angular scales of like 10 arc minutes that people could just Fourier transform at 2.4 gigahertz, this one point that I showed up here. So if one of you ambitious theorists want to do this, it's this data by Uniker. It goes up to galactic latitudes of 20 degrees, so it looks like they get far enough out of the plane. And you could take power spectra of that and get out to angular scales of like 10 arc minutes. So that'd be kind of an interesting thing to do. So at 90 gigahertz, like I emphasized before, I think we're probably in the clear here. Here's the polarization power spectra. And here are all the foregrounds down here. And so, you know, unless something is pretty weird, you know, like if the polarization of the dust is 25% or something, we might be in trouble. Or if, but I think we're probably fairly in the clear at 90. So I'm going to just move on to the atmosphere again. That pretty much covers up the galactic foregrounds. Here are estimates of the brightness spectrum. Matt actually showed you data, and I'm just showing this. These are estimates that we made as a function of day for 1998 using water vapor measurements that are done on balloon soundings. And you could convert those into what you might expect for the sky brightness temperature in Princeton. So at 90 gigahertz, there's a lot of scatter here, and they're up here sort of in the 40 to 80 Kelvin range, and that's roughly what we see here. Clear days. No, the lowest precipitable waters I think that they measure there are sort of 2 millimeters, so that's like a bad day in Antarctica. Okay, so this is the plot that Matt showed, just showing that the brightness temperature, the sky brightness increases as a function of day. But we still got a lot of usable data even into March, so we hope that it's sort of symmetric around the turn of the year, so we might be able to start as early as September or something this year, again observing without getting too hit by the atmosphere. So I did want to show one plot. This is data here of a Jupiter scan. And then these are actually projections. We make a map of Jupiter, and this is a projection. We have two total power channels, and this is projections in co-elevation and elevation here. And what happened during this Jupiter scan was this cloud came by right in the middle of it. And so, as you can see, this is looking pretty ratty, and what's happened here is Jupiter would give us about a 200 millikelvin signal here. But a cloud, a really small cloud, it was like the only cloud in the sky when we were doing the Jupiter scan, came by and like zapped us right in the middle of it. And so gave us about a 700 millikelvin signal. And so that's pretty bad, right? And total power. Yeah. So that was kind of a bummer. And Matt knew that this cloud was going to hit us, and he tried to convince me not to do this observation. But and of course he was right, but so we wasted some time doing it, but we did it anyway. But the good thing is that we don't see anything in the polarization when this cloud goes through. So at the sort of 7 millikelvin level. So that we're sort of immunized against bad things in the atmosphere at least at the sort of factor of 100 level. So that's nice. And I don't know, is that your experience, Phil, when you remember back to your grad student days, how immune you were to... But clearly, observing from Princeton, you would think it's tough, but in polarization, it's actually not too bad. The atmosphere doesn't hit you nearly as bad as it does for temperature. Yeah, sort of get edge effects, I think. Yeah, but we could work on that a little more. So that's sort of the good news, is that the atmosphere is fairly well behaved. Now, before I'm done here, how am I doing on time? Okay. So how do we address these foregrounds? Obviously, the typical way to do it is to have multi-frequencies. But a lot of these initial measurements, including our own and the Polytron, are going to be single frequency, and it's going to be hard. If we get a signal, it's going to be a little tough to say immediately whether it's consistent with C and B or whether it's one of these foregrounds. So we've put together another polarimeter to sort of discriminate against these various foregrounds. And so this is this Q-band polarimeter. It's basically pretty much built. All the RF components are there, and we're just putting the IF box together right now. And we'll hope to begin observing with that this fall. And the idea is that in Q-band, the atmosphere should be considerably even better than in W-band. And what we hope to do is actually turn this into to make full use of our acronym, the PEAK acronym. This will actually be able to do Q and U and I all simultaneously, instantaneously. So we don't have to have, you know, a rotating quarter wave plate. And so this, what we do there is we actually, the incoming radiation goes through an OMT and then into this 90 degree short slot hybrid. And the output of that is at circular polarizations. And then we do the standard mixing down, and in the IF end, we do some microwave trickery and add 90 degree phases, and we can, at the end of the day, we can actually get out both the Q and U Stokes parameters. And then also we're going to get out four temperatures, so we'll get the right and left circular polarized as well as the linear polarizations in temperature. And so, and the temperature should be about, the sensitivity in temperature is about, will be about an order of magnitude worse than the polarization. So that's kind of about right, because the signals in polarization is down by about an order of magnitude. And so we actually will hopefully do anisotropy with this too, not just polarization, but use it for anisotropy. And the nice thing about the right and left circular is that those won't be getting the synchrotron. Well, the linears will be getting the synchrotron, so we can hopefully use to discriminate against synchrotron. So, in summary, these are the RMSs that we expect for the different foregrounds, free synchrotron, vibrational, and spinning dust. And then point sources I didn't mention too much. The estimates, I didn't do too much additional work. It's a good deal of it is in the literature. But it looks like point sources are not going to be a big problem for polarization, not as much as for temperature. So those are all, you know, under a microkelvin at these angular scales and frequencies. So that's it. Oh, sure, I'm sure it could, yeah. Yeah, it's probably somewhere in the 90 to 150 gigahertz. You know, I don't think it's known well enough now to really say. Yeah. Yeah, Matt showed that. So unchopped total power, the equivalent sensitivity, not looking at the sky, would be 1.2. When we're looking at the sky, it's more like 1.8. Of course, we're correlating, and then we're also chopping, so you can multiply by your favorite factors of root 2, too. Oh, okay, the correlation was in there. Sorry. For For synchrotron or for? Okay. Okay. Well, that would be good news, I think. So. Okay. Oh, okay. 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 Great, thanks.
Source and point sources are much more strongly very